Why so serious?
All the toys, all the time.
I am the game, and still getting trying to play you.
You know the rules. This isn't a toy.
But we bought it at the toy store.
We did, but the way I'm using it makes it an adult thing.
Are you ready to play the game?
Yeah! Welcome to the toy department with Matt Kolsky and Derek Madden.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, still here somehow. It's time for another toy department. I'm Derek Madden. He's Matt Kolsky. How are you today, sir?
For some reason, when you said still here, I wanted to sing a chorus of Pearl Jam's Alive.
Yeah, I wouldn't have stopped you from doing that.
Yeah, my voice is a little ragged before noon. So
yeah.
Maybe later in the pod.
I mean, I said still here, obviously, sort of a joke, you know, as a joke, just the fact that we're still doing this pod after all this time is, I think, like, a feat in and of itself, but...
I would say so.
Given the last, you know, couple of days,
yeah.
there is something to appreciate about just still being here, man, you know? Not to be too much of a bummer.
Yeah.
But yesterday was tough, obviously, with a lot of stuff that happened outside the toy department. And then you throw on top of that the loss of Tom Petty.
Yeah.
I was genuinely saddened by that. It was just, and it just kind of came at the worst time. You know what I mean?
Bad timing. Not that there's good timing for a thing like that. But also, you know, 66 is not that old. And I understand Tom Petty lived a hard 66.
Yeah, I was going to say he packed a lot in 66.
But... he wasn't deeply sick or anything.
No, he was not deeply sick. And in fact, had just wrapped up a tour.
And a tour where every review I heard, which was several, was tremendous.
Yeah, I can't remember. I think we talked about it on the pod a little bit because I did go to the local stop of that here.
Mm-hmm.
And really now, really, really glad I did. And it was, I mean, obviously, you would think, given that he died of a heart attack, that he wasn't thinking of this as the final tour.
Right.
But it was.
But you never know.
But it was a perfect tour, you know, for him to go out on. In that, you know, it was about the summation of 40 years of the Heartbreaker. So you really did kind of get to appreciate the breath.
Put a bow on it somewhere.
Yeah. And I think that's an important part of, like, the legacy of Tom Petty, was that he was one of those guys that was there. Just being Tom Petty, you know, no matter how things sort of changed around him, you know, he just sort of fit. And he was, you know, he was there in the 70s. You know,
I mean, he had pop radio hits in the 70s, 80s, and 90s.
Yeah. And, you know, It's
which
weird.
Is an incredible transition. Like, it's one thing to say you had pop hits in three decades, but those decades specifically, that might be as, you know, dramatic changes in the music and popular music industries over three decades as any decades.
Yeah, and look, you could see a time in maybe like the mid-80s where, like, the thing that he did kind of fit when, you know, people like Springsteen and Mellencamp could be stars. You know what I mean? Like, I guess that sort of made sense. But, you know, for him to be a pop star, you know, in 90s MTV dominated culture, you know what I mean? Like,
yep.
Full Moon Fever wasn't released that far from, you know, Tupac and The Chronic. You know what I mean? And that's and to have that be a major hit. And then, you know, for him to also be around, you know, kind of in the punk rock 70s and still be a part of that, you know what I mean? Was like, I don't know. Like, I just think he's an American treasure. He's a fantastic songwriter. And I don't know that you're going to have many more presences like him on the music scene, you know, in our lifetime.
No, I mean, two things about Petty. The first is, you know, Marc Maron has a joke in his latest special, which he was telling on the tour that I saw, that goes something like, you know, basically he's imagining talking to a Trump voter and trying to find common ground. And basically, Tom Petty is the common ground that he can find. Like, it's like, well, we all like Petty, right? And like, and that is a goofy joke, but also, I think, emblematic of, I'm not sure there are other, because I'm not sure Springsteen fits that mold. I don't think Dylan fits that mold. Like, Tom Petty, I think, had a uniquely broad appeal in America specifically.
Yeah.
And he's uniquely American. And I think, and this is the second thing I was going to ask, is he's probably on the Mount Rushmore of American rock music, right?
I mean, you know, that's a whole broader conversation. I just wanted to add to that point, and this isn't mine. I think Bomani Jones actually said it, of all people, on Twitter yesterday, in that I think one of the things that was unique about him was he seemed to be able to speak about the place you were from in a specific way, like, even though he wasn't from there. Right.
Like,
chances are, you know, I actually lived in the town Tom Petty was from, but not many people could say that. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. But yet he felt like he was yours, and that didn't seem to matter if you were from the Midwest or the Southwest or the Northeast. Like, it just seemed like he had something to say about your American life, and that's something like, you know, Springsteen doesn't do that. Like, Springsteen evokes a particular region of the country, right? Yes. As great as he is, you know,
and
what I mean?
Particular attitude towards the country and
yeah,
all that sort of stuff.
And it's not like Tom Petty wasn't like that, or that he wasn't political, or he didn't, you know, have some thoughts about that. In fact, I think, you know, the latter day end Tom Petty was seemed to be almost, you know, he had that kind of old curmudgeon vibe about some of his stuff, but, He did seem to belong to everyone in a way that's hard to put your finger on and really hard to replicate, I think. All right, so if you're talking about the American rock Mount Rushmore, who's on that for you? Four bands or artists, I should say. You got four artists in the American. Do bands count? Or are we talking about solo people?
Well, I mean, I think that's. That's probably the question. I was imagining solo people when I said it. Bands probably makes it tough.
All right, so let's just say solo people then.
Assuming we count Petty as that, because I think we do.
Well, all right. So here we go.
For me, now the question is, there are so many questions here, right? Because what is rock music is a big question. I really opened a Pandora's box with that comment. I apologize. But, does Chuck Berry count?
Yeah, I mean, I think unquestionably Chuck Berry counts.
As rock music?
Yeah, unquestionably to me. Like, I think Chuck Berry in some ways is rock music. Like, he's the start of it.
The thing is, like, if you sort of found the genre, are you of the genre? Yeah. I don't know.
The tough question for me is, does Prince count?
No, he's not rock.
Not
in the city. I wouldn't call Prince gets his own mountain.
And then you sort of have to almost ask, like, if Prince counts, does Michael Jackson count, right? So
right. See, that's the thing, is I think those guys get their own mountains.
But to me, like, more directly than Michael, obviously, like, Prince played a lot of rock music. You know what I mean? So
he played a lot of rock music, but it's uniquely Prince.
Yeah.
I'm not sure I can put any of Prince's music in the genre of Tom Petty and Bob Dylan and even Chuck Berry, for that matter.
I don't know. I think I might argue for him. All right.
Well, Elvis probably belongs in this conversation as well.
Elvis is not on my Mount Rushmore.
I'm not saying he's on. I don't think he's on mine either, but I think he belongs in the conversation. I'm just trying to set the parameters.
Yeah, we should put him in the conversation so I can go, fuck Elvis, and then we can move on.
I think that's probably a stronger position than I have, but I do think he's largely overrated.
This is a good chance for me to drop my theory of almost everything terrible in music originated from the idea of Elvis Presley.
I don't honestly know enough about it to say that. I think probably a lot of good things originated with the idea of Elvis Presley as well.
When you take the formula of let's take music that black guys were doing and put a pretty white face on it, and then homogenize and commercialize it, like that's the Elvis template, and you and like we've seen it time and time again through the history of popular music, and it's gross, and Elvis was gross, and fuck Elvis.
Yeah, that's all true. That pretty much all of that is true, but he also, I mean, I think you also have to at least acknowledge that he did things to move.
Elvis
music
was a hero to most, but he never meant shit to me. Shout out to Chuck D. Okay. all right. So here's what I'm thinking. I'm thinking Dylan. You got to have Dylan. I think that's pretty obvious. You got to have Springsteen on the American Mount Rushmore.
See, I'm not sure you do. I would say the two that I think are unquestionable, if we're going to include Chuck Berry, are Chuck Berry and Bob Dylan.
Hmm. And you're just saying formative? I mean, because when you get to Breath, man, I mean, Springsteen's been a relevant force in music effing long time.
Yeah, so was Elvis, but I'm not comparing the two. I'm just saying the fact that he was relevant for a long time or that he's great. I'm not dissing Springsteen. I don't think he's as foundational as those other two guys.
All right, so who are your other two?
Well, I don't know. Like, for me, I would have Petty over Springsteen.
Oh, yeah. See, I don't know. I think it's tough. I think I would have Springsteen over Petty, but I think there's probably room for both on my Mount Rushmore.
Yeah, I mean, I think that four, Dylan, Barry, Petty, Springsteen, is a pretty good four. You know, I think the question of whether personalities from bands like Kurt Cobain would be involved in the conversation. Do they qualify?
Well, then with Kurt Cobain, obviously you get to the question of body of work, right? In terms of the length of the body of work.
Yeah, but I think again, to me, Mount Rushmore, like, they're not gonna carve a new head for if a president ever accomplishes something again, they're not going to carve a new head into Mount Rushmore. To me, like, part of Mount Rushmore is being like somewhat foundational or game changing. Right.
Well, in that case, like, to me, if you're going to take Cobain, you got to take Hendrix.
Yeah, I think Hendrix is in that. To me, in fact, I might go Barry, Dylan, Hendrix, and Petty. Because I don't know, Springsteen to me is just like he's like a more gregarious Dylan or something. Like, he's just not as, again, foundational to me.
Mm. See, this is hard for me because
American, but it's like this, I don't know.
I'm going to say this.
Doesn't resonate with me the same way for whatever reason.
I'm going to say this, and I have complete respect for the legacy. Obviously, I put him in my Mount Rushmore, but I do not enjoy the music of Bob Dylan. Don't like it.
I
think most of his songs I prefer performed by other people.
I intimately understand that, and I agree with the second part. Many of his songs, I agree. I prefer the other people's versions. But even given that, and even beyond the songs, like what Bob Dylan, I mean, especially given your feelings about Elvis, and especially I'm not done with the statement.
Okay.
Given the way you feel about Elvis, and given the sort of developments in stardom since, I think Bob Dylan in many ways is the first modern rock star.
Yeah, I respect the accomplishments and the influence and what he means, which is why he still made my list.
Well, I feel that way about Springsteen, but if that makes him number six instead of number four, you know, what am I going
to
do?
Yeah, I don't know, man. I think Hendrix needs to be on there for me, so.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I'm sure there's someone else I'm forgetting that I would want to include.
And this to me is also a little bit of a Chuck Berry problem. Like, you're the first guy. You know what I mean? And, like, the Beatles and the Stones were cribbing from you. And so, I, you know, like, I
That's right. And Chuck Berry is a songwriting genius.
But when it comes down to like actually listening to the songs, they don't do anything for me. So like that's, you know, like I start to weigh that.
I'm with you a little bit on Dylan. I kind of feel that way about Springsteen. I get that sentiment. I feel that way about most of Elvis.
Plus you have the Woody Allen R. Kelly rule kind of coming into play there. He's a convicted sex offender.
As we've discussed, I still have Ignition on my Get Pumped.
And I do mix. Not.
See, I still so watch Woody Allen.
You know what I'm saying?
And
like,
I appreciate Chuck Berry. So yeah, I'm a hypocrite.
Yeah, I kind of don't want to be a hypocrite. And I do feel like, you know, I could put other guys on this mountain. I guess is what I'm saying. That like, you know, weren't sex offenders. But that's another story for another day.
You're right. You're absolutely right. I cannot make a conscionable argument against that, but it is what it is. I do my best to separate art from life in those. I guess I feel like I can say.
But the Berry problem is like the Kelly problem in that like their sexuality is like intrinsically tied within their art. You know what I mean? So,
to some degree, yeah, but you know,
and I guess that's also Woody Allen's problem.
Song, too, so. Johnny B. Good is just pure rock and roll.
Yeah,
you listen to the greatest hits of Chuck Berry, and he was at a level no one could have even imagined at that time. Yeah. He was. Everything you said is true, but that's a case where the music does really get me.
All right, so wrap it up. Give me your four. Give me what's your mountain.
I mean, sort of apropos of nothing and just based on how I feel at this moment, I would take Dylan, Hendrix, Berry, and Petty for me. I understand the impact of Bruce Springsteen, and I respect it. But for me, I'll take Petty over Springsteen. I would rather, you know, if you gave me a choice a week ago, free ticket, Petty or Springsteen, I'm going to see Tom Petty.
All right, I'm going to take Petty and Springsteen, and then Dylan and Hendrix, and I'm leaving it at that.
Fair enough.
All right. so either way, you know, whether Tom Petty is one of the five or sixth greatest American solo artists of all time, or one of the top four, like
right.
irreplaceable legend we've lost. He's in that conversation for sure.
Yeah. And I don't think you can minimize the level of quality it requires to be what Tom Petty was for 40 years. In many ways, he, you know, whatever I know the Stones are at what, 50? But Petty had I feel like his like floor was higher. Is that fair? I feel like the Stones had deeper lulls over their stretch of time than Petty did.
Yeah, I mean, Petty has some forgettable stuff, but less of it than some of these other groups. And his late period is not as embarrassing. You know what I mean?
Right, and consistently somewhat relevant over the course of those 40 years.
I mean, the last Petty record you feel like matters was probably Wildflowers, right? That's like mid I think 96 was when the record came out.
That's so, probably true. Yeah. But I guess maybe somehow like we never fell out of love with any of those songs. Yeah. But you know, look, Free Fallin's and Jerry Maguire, for God's sakes, you know?
Yeah, it is. Just and the idea that Tom Petty like adjusted to the MTV era.
Yeah.
Seems so improbable now.
Right? You know? Especially, he's not the most photogenic guy in the world.
Yeah. And by the way, we should also just take a moment, since we're doing the Mount Rushmore, to acknowledge the existence of the Traveling Wilburys.
How incredible is that?
When you're talking about two American Mount Rushmore guys, a Beatle, Roy Orbison, who could have been on that, you know, certainly could have been in that conversation.
Yeah. I don't know if he's rock and roll exactly, but yeah, exactly.
You know, and then you throw in Jeff Lynne for good measure. That's not bad. Yeah. they did okay.
It's pretty incredible.
All right. You want to move on? Should we move on to some of the homework for this week?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Cause we got a lot of it. I'm just going to take this in the order that I got them written down here, because we got a Law and Order extravaganza. Maybe we'll do a little bit later in the show. I'm going to start with Ghosted, which was a show that you suggest we watch on Fox. Adam Scott, Craig Robinson, battling the paranormal.
Yes.
The pilot aired this weekend. What'd you think?
I liked it. I mean, it didn't do anything wildly original in the first episode, but I do feel like I could watch these two characters do the buddy thing for a while. You know, it was entertaining enough. Those two guys are funny enough that I will give this a few episodes to get me a little more hooked.
Yeah, I almost wish that you had assigned this two or three episodes down the road. I didn't really enjoy this show, but it was hard for me to tell if that was just because this was a pilot and it was really doing a lot of pilot stuff. You know what I mean? Really trying to establish who these characters are and the place that they were coming from and, like, you know, sort of the form of the show.
Right. That stuff wasn't super interesting or exciting.
And it felt mechanical and not funny, but I'm willing to allow that that is a possibility of just, hey, this is the pilot and we need to do pilot work.
Right. And so, when they did get into the sort of buddy framework, like, I'm here for that. I'm here for Craig Robinson and Adam Scott being goofy.
I will watch those two slap each other for sure.
Yes.
Like, oh my goodness, I'll be into that. But, like, there wasn't too much more that I enjoyed in that. And, like, I get that they were trying to go maybe for a little bit of a send up of some of these kind of movies, but a lot of that just landed as cliche to me. Like, I know they were sort of going for cliche, but it just sort of felt cliche.
Look. If this is going to be something that runs multiple seasons and really gets us in, there's got to be more to it.
Yeah.
But when I think about, like, what did I love off the bat about it, about, like, a show like Brooklyn Nine-Nine that I now watch regularly, it was the sort of these, in that case, four or five people, I'm ready to watch them play together. And it's going to have to be a little more. There's going to have to be more to it to lock me in.
Yeah.
But I get, it's like after a pilot, it's like I get what they're doing and I'm prepared to entertain it.
I would watch the show again. I wouldn't say I'm excited to watch the show again. I was happy to see, maybe this is, I'm going to reveal a little bit more about myself than I care to, but you know, over the course of your life, you've had a few guilty pleasures, like just completely random shows that you somehow got sucked into watching. Well, one of those for me was an NBC show that I didn't even watch on NBC. It used to just air late nights on Saturday nights in syndication or like Sunday nights. And I would be up and I used to watch this show called Profiler that aired on NBC. It was about this like, I don't know.
Never heard of that.
Yeah, it was about this woman who tracked serial killers. You know, she was a profiler. And the star of that show is like the chief of the bureau on this show. So like I'm into her, I'm into Craig Robinson, I'm into Adam Scott. Like I think it's an interesting cast. I don't know about this weapons expert chick, but whatever. Maybe she'll be good eventually. Like it could be a thing. Sure.
Yes.
But I didn't see a ton of that on the screen so far. So I'm hoping it'll get better.
That's fair. I think that's a fair position. For me, especially when it comes to these sorts of comedies, so much of whether I enjoy it in the long term is about relationships between the leads. And these are two guys I have a lot of trust in from watching them a lot.
Yeah. But I mean, like, as a veteran of many, many Adam Scott TV shows at this point, like, he's not playing in the same ballpark as the, you know, the cast of Party Down or Parks and Rec. You know what I mean? Like, this, so, you know, he's got one or two good running mates, but we'll, I don't know. I'm a little more skeptical, I think.
Okay, fair enough.
Speaking of which, the show I watched last night that, you know, for the homework this week, was Nick. And, here's my elevator pitch for the Mick. do you like, watching It's Always Sunny? Now, imagine we took that and replaced all the dudes with people with children with much less charisma. Is that something I might want to interest you in?
It was not the best episode of the Mick for you to watch. Like, I feel a little bit like you probably felt after BoJack. because it really was the most Always Sunny-ish. Just like there's this hotel situation. Because of the circumstances of the end of last season, this just turned into the most Always Sunny episode. I think it's a little different than that, but also, like, that's part of what it is.
It does it reminds you that, like, it's Always Sunny. It's harder to pull off than you think, right? Because, you know, that's a show, and there are a few other shows that do this. I'm not saying it's the only one, but it's a show where you have people who are obviously irredeemably horrible people.
Well, right. I mean, sneakily, the first show like that is Seinfeld.
Yeah. But, like, you have to... There has to be something about them that attracts you to them and that makes you want to spend time with them to make the show work. And I think that's a hard thing to pull off. It is.
Now, I will say, on the Mick, while it may not have come across on this episode, I would argue that the virtually all of the characters on the show have some of that, with the exception of maybe the redhead kid, who's a total douche, but that's kind of his thing. Caitlin Olsen just exudes that to me. Like, that's what she is as an actress, is someone who's capable of being awful, but somehow engaging and redeeming in such a way that makes you root for her.
Yeah. Almost to the point with her where I'd like to see her do something else.
That's fair.
Just one other thing.
Her job in this show, and I think she does that. Yeah. And I think she did that even in this episode. I also think what you didn't see is ordinarily the sort of cleaning lady character, the little boy and the daughter, as well as like her dirtbag boyfriend, all have these sort of redeeming qualities in some way that make them appealing and interesting. And this episode was really just carnage.
Yeah. Like, the boyfriend just kind of came off as like Mac Light sort of, you know what I mean?
I think he's different than that. Over the course of the first season, there was a little more, you learned more about him, and he was more established as, like, yes, this sort of bizarre, sad man who's chasing her around, but also, like, there's more there. And the daughter was a really interesting, although it's all absurd, don't get me wrong, but the daughter was a more interesting character in the first season as well. So, I think if you watched episode one of season two of The Mick, there is more to this show than you saw in that episode, but at the same time, like, you get the idea.
Right. Yeah, I get the idea.
that is the idea.
All right.
I'm not going to deny that's the idea.
I have repeatedly made some off-pod pleas to, like, get you to watch a couple more BoJacks.
Yeah, I'll get there. I haven't yet, but I'll get there.
If you do that for me, then I would be willing to watch some more Mix. But otherwise, I don't know that I'm coming back.
Fair enough. We'll take those negotiations off pod.
Fair enough. Although I will say that one episode of BoJack you should watch, like, soon, because it's
okay.
Timely.
I'll get to it.
It's
take
timely.
It easy.
Yeah.
Calm down.
Okay. You'll see what I mean.
Calm down about BoJack.
Okay? It's really good. I'm sorry.
All right. I would like to transition to the other TV show we watched.
Okay, hit me. There was actually two. So
there were?
Yeah, there are. So I'm curious to see which one you're talking about.
Oh, well, one we've been watching, though. Yeah. No, I'm talking about the one that also premiered this week, Law & Order True Crime.
Yeah, where are you at on this one?
You know, I've read the reviews that say it's just sort of a poor man's People versus OJ.
Oh, is that what the reviews are saying?
I've seen some.
That's, now I don't know what I'm going to say. What's my turn?
Yeah, sorry. I get that. I felt that. That's there. But I think that has more to do with the fact that it's the Menendez brothers' crime story is a poor man's OJ crime story.
Yeah, it's true.
Because I don't see a drastic reduction in production value or the quality of the performance in one episode. I'm pumped to see Edie Falco do this. I'm excited for that.
Yeah.
You know, so
here's the thing is I feel like the cast bench is not nearly as deep as OJ. Fine. So maybe that's part of the, like, yeah, you know, Edie Falco name, and Josh Charles. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, I'm in on those guys. You know, I think also you're right. In some ways, the Menendez is a poor man's OJ's case, and you have a lot of the same ridiculous hair and 90s outfits going on. You know what I mean?
But also, I don't think we shouldn't minimize what a big story that was.
Yeah.
Because that was, being a kid and having no real awareness of the news at large, pretty much the two stories I remember from the 90s are OJ and the Menendez brothers. And obviously, like, I knew who OJ was before he murdered two people, allegedly. I had obviously never heard of anybody named Menendez. So the fact that that was a national story that registered with a, you know, a 10 to 14 year old or whatever I was when this happened, that's noteworthy.
Yeah, but I don't know about you, but I know a lot less about the actual story of the, you know, the real life Menendez brothers story than I do about the OJ trial.
That's right. You but it's, I mean? Still, it's, that's the difference between a huge, one of the biggest news stories of the 90s and probably the biggest news story in the history of the country.
Yeah. And then I would say that's an advantage for Law and Order, honestly. I mean,
yeah,
I think one of the things before you watched the FX OJ version, right, that was one of the things you're like, well, God, what are they going to say about this that we don't already know? And they didn't even really try to tell you too many things that you didn't already know, actually.
No,
they just told the story so well, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, but I don't see, that's what I'm saying about this, is I don't understand why anyone would assume that a good version of this story is not forthcoming. I thought, based on one episode, it's not going to be The Wire, but it's, I think a good story is forthcoming, and I am not unexcited to see it.
It's interesting. I mean, we are, and obviously we're going to get into this a little bit more, but, and I think maybe we talked about it some last week. You and I are both big fans of the original Law and Order. So, like, yes, we're not, you know, when you say Law and Order, that is a plus for us. We're excited about it.
And this
that.
Is not Law and Order, really.
It isn't. I did sort of feel like, you know, one of the, most times, I think we're not looking for the kind of show that wraps itself up in 60 minutes on sort of a pattern.
Right.
But, like, Law and Order was so good at that, you know? And, well, and I did I sort of feel
argument.
Like the open-ended narrative it didn't fit the makers of this show quite as well as the taut structure of a typical Law and Order kind of did.
Perhaps, and there, I think there's a separate conversation to be had about the fact that clearly the original Law and Order should be brought back. But I also think this has the potential to be a good, entertaining show about a major storyline from the news in our lives. And I don't necessarily agree, based on one episode, that this is a poor man's People versus OJ in any respect other than the fact that it's a less prominent crime with less known story.
Yeah, well, and don't get too hung up on that. Like, People versus OJ was probably my favorite show of that year. So you can be a poor man's People versus OJ and still be
really good.
Pretty watchable. Yeah, like, so yeah. I don't know that that's necessarily, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's a little shade, but I don't know if that's like a death sentence. You know what I mean? Like, I don't.
Right.
I'm not here to not recommend. You know, like, this is not a. I don't know that I would necessarily recommend the first two shows that we talked about. Certainly not yet. But I would feel more comfortable recommending this, particularly because I almost just want to see what Edie Falco is going to do. You know.
Completely agree. I never watched Nurse Jackie. So
I did watch Nurse Jackie. So I can comment on
too,
that.
I think. I bet people like it, but I just didn't for whatever reason, no particular reason.
It's not a bad show, but you know, I mean, she's clearly the thing happening in it. You know right. what I mean?
Either way, the point is, when I watched Horace and Pete, I had not seen Edie Falco in a very long time, and I was reminded how wonderful she is.
Yeah.
And I'm really excited to see her play a totally different role on a television show about an interesting story. I like after that pilot first episode, I was ready for more. I enjoyed it. And so even though I can understand where the criticism is coming from and it's not unreasonable, it does seem unnecessary to me.
Fair. I mean, it was just one of those things that just jumped out at me.
Yeah, but I think that's the date. I mean, look, this is modern. This is the modern television market and environment. Okay, you get one thing that does really well, and everybody races out to make their version of it.
Yeah,
and so it's not surprising that something that looks and feels in many ways like a really great show from last year is now on the air on a different network. That's the most 2017 America thing that could possibly happen. That doesn't mean it's not good.
Yeah. No, I agree. It just...
That's where I'm at.
I just wonder if you were getting the Stone Temple Pilots to, you know, to OJ's Nirvana. You know what I mean? Where it's like, hey, there's a lot to like there, but also not quite as good. You know what I mean?
Okay, fine, but Stone Temple Pilots was a great band, and it still is.
I prefer Lemonade.
I'm not saying today's Stone Temple Pilots are a great band, but those days, Stone Temple Pilots are still great.
Indeed. I don't think you've heard the last of Stone Temple Pilots, by the way. I believe they're still auditioning singers right now.
I have heard the last of Stone Temple Pilots.
Fair enough. I, unfortunately, my occupation, have not heard the last of Stone Temple Pilots, so I'll send you an update.
Isn't that disrespectful to you? Shouldn't they change the name?
I don't know. No, I mean, because
it's not Mick Jones. Okay, I understand lots of bands change members over time, but it's Scott Weiland, for God's sakes. It's not the Stone Temple Pilots if Scott Weiland is not there. It's just not. And
well,
calling it that is an insult to the fans and to his memory.
Hold on a second.
Really, it offends me.
When Chester Bennington was the singer, like, and they called it Stone Temple Pilots.
That's also offensive, but it's more so now because the man has passed away.
I don't
both of those men, as a matter of fact.
I didn't have a problem with that. I didn't. Particularly since you knew that they were all kind of openly feuding and whatever.
But why can't you be Audio Slave? You know what I mean? Audio Slave's not Rage Against the Machine. It's a different band. It's also a good band.
Yeah.
It's also a good band. I'm not here to tell you whether or not the Chester Bennington Temple Pilots are a good or bad band. I never listened to them once. I'm not prepared to make that judgment. But I am prepared to say they're distinctly not the Stone Temple Pilots.
Yeah, all right. I guess that's fair. I think maybe I have a little bit more liberal view of the history of the Stone Temple Pilots. But
I understand that the whatever their names are, the brother, DeLeo.
DeLeo brothers, yes.
I understand they probably see themselves as the important foundational members of the Stone Temple Pilots, and I'm not discrediting them.
I
also don't think it would be the Stone Temple.
Having talked to them about this some, I think they have a fair place, a fair view of their place in the history. I think that they wrote the music for the most part, but I think they also understand, what the band, the impact that Scott Weiland had in that band and the way that they're known. Like, I don't think
why do they persist with the name?
You know, because Scott Weiland isn't coming back to the band. He's not walking through that door.
Right. So why can't you just say the band died with him and now we're a new band?
I guess, but like
with some of the same members.
I mean, it's the same reason why are any of these other classic rock bands touring with like one or two original members? Because that's the easiest way for them to make money.
I guess to me, it's a little different to be a nostalgia act. Like if you're trying to say you're still you're still a reasonably current band in some way. I don't know.
Yeah, well, I think they're trying to have it both ways.
This is probably a pointless bicker.
Ultimately, at the end of the day, you're gonna do you're gonna call it the thing that's gonna get you the most and the best paying gigs, right?
Yeah, I guess so. That's who am I to criticize that? Before we get too far afield, we got to go back to Law and Order.
Yes, we do. All right. So, one of our homework assignments this week was all time. I mean, I guess really we could just say your Mount Rushmore of Law and Order, right?
Yeah.
Now, I mean, instead of Mount Rushmore, because you're not going to have four spots, but no, like...
Because there's six, I actually made eight spots on mine, which don't worry, you'll see. It's not as flagrant cheating as you think. And I also have a series of honorable mentions that I would like to put out.
Yeah. So that's the thing. It's like, I prefer that you would do six and just honorable mentions. Like, there are some hard choices.
I have eight, but also six and honorable mention. You'll see.
All right. Lay it on me then.
Just want me to do my whole team?
You want to do? Let's do the law side first.
Okay. Why don't I start with number seven and eight, okay. Just so you understand what I did here. Because obviously the six is you got a captain or lieutenant or whatever, a senior detective and a junior detective.
Oh well, technically that's the order side, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Okay. That's the order. I'm just saying I'm putting it all together.
Okay.
And then on the law side, you've got an actual DA, the sort of big DA,
right?
The ADA, and then the sort of AADA, if right. you will.
Mm-hmm.
I also, if I'm going to make an all-time Law and Order team, I also want to have a psychiatric consultant and medical examiner.
All right, yeah. So, see, I was going to ask you about, like, okay, your favorite, like, ancillary characters.
So my two ancillary characters are BD Wong, who, of course, played FBI Special Agent George Huang on the show, largely on SVU. Also, I believe, appeared on the original once or twice.
Yeah, more than once or twice, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then Tamara Tooney, who plays Emmy Melinda Warner, the regular Emmy on SVU, but again, has appeared on the other ones, did some Criminal Intent, I believe, has sort of long, curly hair. You would immediately recognize her.
I know exactly who you're talking about, yeah.
Yes. She has testified many times. So those are my two ancillary, the psych consultant and the medical examiner, because obviously you need that for your Law and Order.
Now,
team.
Can I take BD Wong and J.K. Simmons?
Yeah,
I mean, because J.K. Simmons was psychiatric, right? He wasn't.
Yeah.
Yeah, they both were, yeah. though. Yeah, but those, yep. those are the two I want.
And there was a lady, too. There was a lady psychiatrist.
Dr.
Well.
Elizabeth something or other, right?
That's right.
She was
right.
She did the most of them, as I recall.
Yes, she did the most of the original Law and Order. BD Wong did the most SVU, and J.K. Simmons did do some psychiatric consulting on the original. That's right. True.
Before we get to the rest of your team, do you have anyone from Criminal Intent or Law and Order LA, which I forgot existed?
I did watch those, but no, I have no one from that. I have two.
Also, Trial by Jury. I didn't remember that one either. That was a thing too, apparently.
Yes, I watched it all. I have technically three honorable mentions, although really just two from Criminal Intent. And those are, do you want me to say those off the bat?
Yeah, hit me.
My top honorable mention, second place for ADA, behind the obvious first place, was Courtney B. Vance, who played ADA Ron Carver on Criminal Intent.
Gotcha.
And was typically Courtney B. Vance incredible.
Yeah, he's good at stuff.
as my third best, so second honorable mention for police chief, lieutenant, captain type position was Eric Bogosian, who was hilarious in that role because he just never looked like a policeman to me.
But nobody made your starting five, though, right?
No one made
it's
my...
It's not really starting six. It's more of a starting
no
six.
No one
anyway,
from Criminal Intent made my starting six, although I used a Criminal Intent quirk to put my top honorable mention for senior detective. I made Chris Noth because they brought him back as a senior detective. He, of course, was a junior detective on the very first few seasons of the original.
Yeah, great.
He became a senior detective on Criminal Intent, and I wanted to give him a shout out, but I had too many in the junior detective category.
Chris Noth just works, man. That's what that dude does. He just works.
Yep, he's a working man. While we're running through my honorable mentions, here's a few more. For the assistant DA, I have two honorable mentions. One, I think, really came close to winning for me, and that is Angie Harmon as ADA Carmichael on the original Law and Order, because she's Angie Harmon and she was fantastic.
The thing is like, she's Angie Harmon, but she can't act at all.
No, she can't act at all, but she was perfect for that role. I loved it. I also wanted to give a shout out to someone I thought was really good in a short-lived role as ADA or AADA, and that was Elizabeth Rome, who played Serena Sutherland on the original Law and Order. The blonde, you know,
right?
You know,
she was the one that they just like made her a lesbian at the end for like no real reason, right?
I don't remember that, but it's certainly possible. Yeah. She was great. I'm a big fan of her in general. She also is a long-running character on the show Angel. But if we're doing... Oh, also an honorable mention to Stephen Hill, who played Adam Schiff, the original big head DA.
Okay. But he's all right, but he's not in your... Do you have Diane Wiest as the head DA? I
absolutely do. The interim DA, Nora Lewin. Diane Wiest is my number one. I don't understand why they ever took her off, because Fred Thompson is a pedantic, pompous prick. And I loved Diane Wiest as the DA. She was like a thoughtful... I feel like when she was DA... McCoy and her had the most interesting conversations about cases.
Interesting. All right.
Love Diane Wiest.
My DA is Stephen Hill as Adam Schiff.
It's a classic. Really argue with it.
That was easy for me. Like, and I feel like he's a guy that, like, he was, of all of these people, he's the one who most seemed like he could actually be the DA, right? He just had
Diane Wiest seemed like the sort of person that really could have become a DA, but a different kind of... Yes. Adam Schiff, DA Adam Schiff is the old grumbly, 30-year prosecutor
Who
becomes DA.
But, like, he was crusty but thoughtful, which is a really hard combination to pull off. You know what I mean? He could surprise you.
Stephen Hill.
Yeah.
He was great. But I think the Diane Wiest, DA Nora Lewin, is the politician DA.
See, I never bought her as someone who could, like, Fred Thompson, and, you know, I mean, look, he's probably helped by the fact he was an actual politician. But he seemed much more believable as a person who could be elected DA than Diane Wiest.
Nah, I thought he was over the top. I prefer Diane. So,
all right. I didn't really enjoy Fred Thompson's work either. This one was the easiest one for me. It's like, oh, it's Adam Schiff.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, because the easiest one for me was Sam Waterston.
The easiest one for me is Jerry Orbach.
He doesn't even count. Yeah. But no. But after that. Of the order side, Sam Waterston was the easiest to me because there are plenty of good ADAs throughout Law and Order history. None of them touch Jack McCoy.
Sam Waterston is,
you know the scene in Entourage as I am Queens Boulevard? Sam Waterston is Law and Order.
I would agree with that. No one gave a fiery closing argument.
Sam Waterston. What was so incredible about Sam Waterston's performance is that for like 15 or 20 years, this guy managed to convince me that A, he's like the best ADA in the history of ADAs, and B, he's like just crusty and unoriginal and unartistic enough to be actually believable as someone who would be a DA for 20 years.
Yep. It was weird because he was, you know, he was a true prosecutor, you know what I mean? Like, obsessed with the job, would pull all kinds of shenanigans to try to bring people down, you know what I mean? And yet you still felt like he legitimately cared about what was right.
He was a good guy. He was doing it the right way.
Even though he was doing it the wrong way. Yeah. I think that's a hard thing to pull off, you know what I mean? And it's the sort of thing that's the template. Like, when you look at, like, Vic Mackey from The Shield, you know, who I think was really became the template for the TV Golden Age anti-hero.
Right.
Like, I see a lot of Jack McCoy in him, you know?
Somehow you're convinced that despite his constant flouting of at least the spirit of the law, if not the letter of it, despite the constant just... crossing boundaries, you somehow are convinced that this man believes in righteousness and is ultimately righteous.
Correct. Okay, so this one I'm guessing was maybe the hardest pick for you.
This was one of the hardest.
Who was your starting five AADA?
I actually cheated.
Okay.
And I guess you could see this as sexist. Because I chose someone who I believe technically was just an ADA. But she's a lady.
and somehow she fits more because just the shows are different. And on SVU, Diane Neal plays ADA Casey Novak, the redheaded ADA from, like, I think she's like season 2 to 5 or 7 or something like that.
Okay,
Law and Order SVU.
I had to look her up on Wikipedia, but I got it.
Yeah, okay. I love her.
All right,
and I obviously couldn't put her ahead of Sam Waterston. But if we're going to get two ADAs, basically, I figure, to me, she's bigger and better and more important in the Law & Order universe than any of the actual original Law & Order assistants were. Although, again, Angie Harmon and Elizabeth Rome both get love from me.
Angie Harmon and Elizabeth Rome get love from me, but those would not be my pick.
Jill Hennon.
What? No, also not my Jill Hennessy also gets some love from me. Also not my pick.
Wow.
I'm going with Carrie Lowell. The former Mrs. Richard Gere. Sure, also the former Mrs. Griffin Dunn, apparently, as well. I guess she's married well.
That's correct.
Over the years, as assistant DA Jamie Ross, uh-huh. who I felt like seemed to be the most competent as of all of the ADAs, and yep. the not afraid to really push some buttons. Eventually, came back on the show a couple of times. I just liked her. So that's my choice for that. That was a tough one, though. Could have been a lot of ones.
I believe they brought her back as part of the whole L.A. Thing.
Yeah, that's possible. I didn't really watch that one.
Or like one of those. One of those they sort of brought her around, I think. She, I'm a fan of all of these women, to be perfectly honest.
Yep.
But Diane Neal is my number one.
I do think that's it is one of the nice things about Law & Order is that they were able to take this role that really could have just been sort of the same thing, and they did a good job of making each of them sort of distinct, you know?
Oh, yeah. And actually, that, I think, is why I loved the D.A. Casey Novak the most, is she ultimately became, as so many of the SVU characters do, became embroiled in her own legal issues and was, you know, a victim in her own right. And you got to know more about her and sort of dug into her a little bit, and I love that actress. Well, so,
you know, that's an SVU thing, is I think they were a little bit more into personal lives.
No, definitely. But I that's what I'm saying. I think maybe that is part of what led me to choose her, is like knowing her a little better.
The one person that we didn't really cover in this discussion was the original, who was a dude. Paul Robinette.
Shout to Paul,
right?
Robinette, yeah. Because he plays one of my favorite characters in the Joss Whedon show Firefly.
Yeah, we watch too much TV. All right, let's get the order side here.
Isn't that the whole premise of this podcast?
It is. We kind of gave away one of the detectives already, because, I mean, of course,
Jerry Orbach is unchallenged.
Yeah, you know what I mean. It just is. Just is what it is.
Detective Lenny Briscoe is the GOAT. Period. End of story.
Who's your chief?
I thought a lot about this, and Dan Florek gets mad props for double duty.
Agreed.
But it's got to be Epitha, S. Epitha Merkerson.
Yeah.
Anita Van Buren. She had that sort of same quality that we were talking about with McCoy, where she made you believe that she was sort of this veteran of the force who had to go through stuff to get where she was.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get a ton of background, but you would get these glimpses into her background that just bolstered the believability of who she was. And, you know, like a woman police lieutenant in the mid 90s in charge of a couple of dudes was a great look for TV.
Yeah, and no one portrayed the, like,
a woman of color, mind you.
I'm a police woman in the middle of an ethical quandary.
Totally,
quite the way Anita Van Buren did. Like,
totally, and they didn't shy away from that at a time where '97 was not 2017. I'm not saying it's the '70s either, but they did not shy away from her being a black woman and how that affected her perspective. And I think that was one of the cool things Law and Order did.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I would agree with that. I was, yeah, I mean, she's great.
She's excellent and great name. One of the great names in show business, S. Epitha Merkerson.
Yep. I am surprised how many of these we've had the same, to be honest. I thought we were going to be a little bit different.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think right now we've only had, well, I guess if you count B.D. Wong, we've had four the same. Yeah. But two of them are just unquestioned.
Yeah,
I mean, there's just nothing you can do about McCoy and Briscoe. That's it.
All right, so Briscoe's in. So to me, the who your second detective is going to be,
yes,
is like, this is the hardest call on the whole board.
By far the hardest call. Shouts to all of the original junior detectives from the original Law and Order.
So many good ones.
That's, you know, Chris Noth, Benjamin Bratt. I thought all those guys were great.
Where do you stand on Jesse L. Martin?
He's my guy.
Yeah? That's your guy?
Yes.
That's your guy? All right.
I know people don't, with the highest of respect for, if you gave me a pair of lesser detectives, I'm taking Belzer and Ice-T. Because the sort of sideshow buddy comedy of detective DA investigator John Munch and detective Finn Tutuola, that may be my favorite thing in the entire Law and Order universe. Maybe Ice-T and Richard Belzer being ridiculous in the early seasons of SVU.
Yeah, shout out to Belzer's Richard Munch for sure.
Phenomenal. Belzer is a legend. But if I'm talking about, I want the guy on the street with Jerry Orbach, I want Jesse L. Martin. And I know people think he was like too theatrical or something, but I loved that buddy pairing. And I thought of all the cop pairings, none of them gave me the sort of buddy movie juice that Orbach and Martin did.
Hmm. All right. That's an interesting call. I don't think I would have gone there. I want to give some more shout outs because I feel like the late period Law and Order guys, are very good actors. Yeah. Anthony Anderson, Jeremy Sisto. Yeah. Like yeah, don't get a lot of credit. Those are not my choices.
No,
I'm going with, Elliot Stabler, Christopher Maloney from SVU.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah, and I thought about Mariska too. I mean, Mariska gets something, right? Like, there's like a lifetime achievement award, yeah, or like a like, you know, she's Lou Gehrig, right? Mariska is Lou Gehrig, or Cal Ripken, whoever, and she deserves respect. But man, Christopher Maloney, he made those early seasons of SVU.
Yeah. Yeah, like the intensity.
He had it all. Yeah. He was a complicated policeman. He had foibles, and he would fly off the handle and go too far. Yeah. But he cared deeply about people and protecting the weak and the innocent, and complicated guy, man.
Yeah, and I know the show eventually became about Mariska Hargitay, but I feel like that could only happen once Maloney was like, I don't want to do this anymore, right?
So a little bit. And that's no shade. Mariska's great. Again, Cal Ripken. But Cal Ripken's Cal Ripken's not friggin' someone better than Cal Ripken.
Yeah, like
screw baseball.
I feel like she's almost Karl Malone. Like if Karl Malone would have been gajillion trophies.
If Karl Malone wasn't such a miserable prick,
because she did win all the awards, but she was there. She was the lead player for a long ass time. You know, yeah, Steve Nash is fine,
right? But she's not Michael Jordan.
I agree.
But Steve Nash was great for a long time and won awards and was great.
Yeah, we never saw them together. But if you could give me. Briscoe and Stabler as a team, like that's a dream team right there to me. So
yeah, man, Lenny Briscoe talking Stabler off the edge. I love it.
Calming him down with wisecracks.
How awesome would it be if they brought back the original Law and Order? I mean, obviously they don't have Lenny Briscoe anymore, but if they just made it like a rotating detective pairings of
people who did it before. Hits. Yeah, that'd be fantastic. I mean, we didn't even like
Benjamin Bratt and Christopher Maloney.
Yeah.
you know,
or like Paul. Paul Sorvino's dead too, isn't he? At this point, I don't remember. But
wait, who?
Paul Sorvino.
Yeah, Paul Sorvino for sure. He was the first senior detective.
Yeah, good one. Like, I love Law and Order.
Me too. And here's the good news: is with all the Law and Order, like if I just flip on TNT and there's a Law and Order on, there's at least like a 30-40% chance that I don't totally remember what happens and can enjoy it again.
Yeah, That's fair. As omnipresent as it's not quite as omnipresent as it used to be, which is sort of just perfect. And I don't actually do, unfortunately, a lot of like just random TV flipping anymore. But yeah, if you land on a Law and Order, you were never disappointed.
I think we're going to have to postpone the other TV show at this point. I don't think we have time to do The Deuce.
Oh, yeah. We can talk about The Deuce next week. I don't mind watching The Deuce develop a little bit. I will say I'm enjoying it.
Me too. Interestingly enough, my parents are not. Not that they're an emblem for anything in particular, but they didn't like it, or they're not super engaged with it. They like the performances. They don't find it super engaging. So as we watch these, you know, the one yesterday and the upcoming, just I don't know. I'm trying to think about that and what it is.
I would say yes, but how many David Simon shows have you heard people say that through five episodes? You know what I mean?
I feel the same way, but I don't feel that way. And so I would like to try to identify specifically what it is that I love. I also want to mention a few music albums, as they call them.
Okay.
There is one. There's a piece of news that broke during our podcast that's going to make you very angry
breaking news. No.
I want to drop that on you at the end, but first, three albums that have come out over the last few weeks that I'm wondering if you've heard, and if not, perhaps you could listen and we could discuss.
Okay.
One I'm quite sure you have heard, which of course is the Foo Fighters album, but we never talked about it.
That's correct. I have heard that one.
You have a 1 minute review?
It's Foo Fighters Eagles record. There's a 10 second review for you right there.
That sounds like a bad review.
It kind of is. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. I don't totally disagree. Although I think I'd probably be more generous. I don't think it's a bad record.
There's a lot of Joe Walsh influence on that record. A lot more than I had expected or hoped for. I'll put it that way.
That's fair. That is fair. What about the band Always?
I had a feeling you might be asking me this because I follow you on Spotify and I saw you listening to it yesterday. But I have not heard that record, no.
Okay. It's a record called Antisocialites. You know who they are?
I do know who they are, yeah.
Okay. For those who don't, I would describe them as a female-fronted dream pop, indie dream pop sort of band. Is that fair?
Yeah, I'd say that's fair.
I kind of dug it. It's exactly what I just described. But I found the album a cool listen, Antisocialites. And then actually, I think the album of the three that I enjoyed the most, Death From Above 1979 has a new album called Outrages Now.
All right. I have heard a couple songs from that. We played some songs here on 93X from that record. So,
how do you feel?
I like what I've heard so far. I like the band. It's not really a review of the full record, which I would need to spend some time with.
Let's do that. Let's do that especially. I don't think we need to waste our time with Foo Fighters. I'm comfortable with your 10-second review.
Okay.
But let's check out Always, Antisocialites, and Death From Above 1979, Outrage Is Now, because I think one is worth hearing, and I actually think the Outrage Is Now, I think it's a really good album. So let's dig in a little bit to that.
I am going to give you an assignment, and depending on the result, there's a good chance we may not talk about this on the show next week, but I'm just going to ask each and every one of you to watch the USA versus Panama on Friday. That is a must-win game for the United States to make the World Cup.
Which, by the way, is a horrifying embarrassment in and of itself.
It is a little bit. It's certainly, if they do not make the World Cup, that would be a horrifying embarrassment. So,
no, really, though. Think about the conversations we've had about soccer on this podcast in the last year. They're all exciting. They've all been excitement conversations about how we finally have a legitimate player. We finally have a world relevant soccer athlete.
Yeah.
And to be on the verge of not making the cup in those circumstances is pathetic.
Yeah, and it's a sort of a weird set of circumstances that has gotten us to this place. There was some mismanagement by the previous administration.
It should never happen.
Maybe some mismanagement by this administration.
It should never, ever, ever happen at this stage. We are not a world power in soccer, but we are certainly...
We're certainly a power in the... CONCACAF region of soccer.
That's exactly right. So. In the region we have to win or you know, be amongst the top of to get into the World Cup, we should be dominating. Right. And the fact that we're not is sad.
So this will be fun. It'll be fun to watch us in a must-win match against a team that is going to really try to park the bus and play discipline and beat us on the counter, and we're going to have to create and unlock against that kind of team. And so I think it'll be a fun match to watch, whether we wind up talking about it or not. Support your damn country. Watch the match. I think
Panama will be reasonably happy to draw this match. Yeah. So
the other thing that I do want to talk about and ask you to watch is a new show on Netflix. And I'm a little nervous to talk about this because I know we're hitting in an area.
Is it the Nick Kroll cartoon?
It is a Nick Kroll cartoon called Big Mouth.
Okay, you don't have to argue it for me. I was thinking about recommending this, but I did not want to embolden you as regards cartoons. So I'm glad you brought it up. I am happy to watch a couple episodes. I heard a couple interviews with Nick Kroll and Jason Mantzoukas, and I am interested.
From what I'm told, it is filthy as hell.
I like that
your voice cast. You've got Nick Kroll, John Mulaney, who do great work together and are funny individually in their own right. Jesse Klein, who's also very funny and writes for a lot of people you also think are very funny. She runs the Amy Schumer Show, and among other things, I believe. Jason Mantzoukas, who we love. Jenny Slate, Fred Armisen, Maya Rudolph, and Jordan Peele. That's your regular cast. And then there are all sorts of guest appearances from people you think are hilarious: Andrew Rannells, Rob Hubel, Kristen Bell, Chelsea Peretti, Mark Duplass, Paul Scheer, Kristen Wiig, Ali Shawkat, John Hamm, Craig Robinson, Jack McBrayer.
Yeah, I'm like sold.
this looks like it's going to be really fun already, for God's sakes. Yeah. So watch Big Mouth, which is now available on Netflix, and I think that's our show.
No, it's not.
Oh. Dun, 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 dun.
Do you know what happened in the NFL while we were talking?
I do not. What happened in the NFL while we were talking?
I assume you're aware that Marcus Mariota sustained injury.
I am aware of that, yeah.
Weekend. Mm-hmm. So it might make sense that the Tennessee Titans would be adding to their quarterback depth chart.
Oh, is Colin Kaepernick have a job, ladies and gentlemen?
Brandon Whedon.
You did that good. You did that good. I was wondering, like this has to be something the way you're drawing this out. And you drew it out for Brandon Whedon.
Brandon Whedon.
The Weed Man.
I mean, we're not getting into this discussion again, but putting aside sort of weird disagreements in philosophy between Derek and I, if you've ever seen Brandon Whedon play quarterback and you can see him get signed while Colin Kaepernick sits at home and not think something fishy is happening, God bless you, man. Yep. You are better at lying to yourself than I could ever hope to be.
Behind yet another improvisational, sometimes running quarterback.
Behind a guy who literally is just pretty much a better version of Colin Kaepernick.
Yeah.
I mean, all that, you know, there's a big difference because Marcus Mariota is young and ascending and already better than Kaepernick ever was. But skill set, very, very, very similar.
Yeah. Yeah.
Again, Kaepernick not accurate, Mariota accurate, but basic skill set, you know, strong-armed quarterback with running ability.
And Mariota actually hasn't been all that accurate this season, although he was last year.
Fair enough. The point is, like, Brandon Whedon is the opposite of that.
Brandon Whedon is just demonstrably terrible. That's it.
He's demonstrably terrible. He's never been any good. He's never done anything to suggest he'll ever be any good. He came into the league at like 30, so he was never going to ascend or improve. And lead-footed nothing behind center. So you just can't possibly look at this and believe it's a football move. You can't. It's not reasonable.
Yeah. Wow. All right. I didn't really think that's where you're going.
That's more or less that.
But yeah, you're right. I could see how that's going to get me all wound up again.
So, yep. Sorry.
So remember that when you're understanding on the sideline, locked arm in arm with everybody, they're still going to punish this kid.
Keep in mind, this is a week and a half after Jerry effing Jones kneeled. Okay. Exactly. So I think it's safe to say that kneeling is not precisely the issue.
Tough but fair.
It's a real bad deal. Well, Brandon Whedon is really, that's really beyond the pale.
Thank you for bumming me out at the end of the show. I appreciate that as always.
Sorry, bye.
This game's in the Admiral refrigerator. The door is closed, the light's out. Butter's getting hard, the eggs are cooling, and the Jell-O is jiggling.
So long, everybody.
And do me a favor, have yourself a tremendous evening.